Welcome to the Solo 2.0 podcast, where two sisters, Jess and Rye, focused on health and hormone balance to help you step into that 2.0 version of you.
Growing up, we heard all about hormones.
Sometimes more than we wanted.
From our mom, who is a hormone health educator.
As we got older, we rebelled and experienced our own health struggles and ups and downs. But today we have businesses helping people get in tune with their bodies, break free from restrictive eating and lifestyle habits, and learn how to balance their hormones naturally. So what can you expect from this podcast?
Honest conversations and hot topics that should be more mainstream, like period health, cycle tracking, non-hormonal birth control, and our unique take on fad diets and trends that aren't always so supportive for women. Plus, interviews with health and wellness entrepreneurs making a big impact in the world.
Ladies, it's time we align with our powers and redefine what healthy means to us.
Let's get into it.
Welcome back to the Solo 2.0 podcast. This is Ryan, co-founder of Your Hormone Balance. And although my sister, Jess Dukan of Body Bliss by Jess, is joining me in the interview that we're about to share, it's just me for the intro here so that I can just give a brief overview of who our guest is and what we talked about. So you can get excited for what's to come. I also wanted to just follow up on the intro I did in last week's episode. If you listened to it, I shared, I got vulnerable and shared about sort of the pitfalls of entrepreneurship and feeling, you know, sometimes guilty in the health and wellness world when you're working a lot and you're stressed, but yet you're giving health advice to others. And I talked about how I think entrepreneurship should come with a warning sign. But, you know, in thinking back on it, I really just wanted to make sure that I'm not discouraging anyone. If you've got a great idea for a business, everyone's path is so uniquely different. And there are wonderful things about entrepreneurship as well. And I think the other week when I recorded that, I was having a bit of a down week, a down day, but things are looking up. And, you know, it's always ebbs and flows. That's the reality of it. But I did want to just, you know, say there's 1,000 reasons to start your own business and wonderful freedom and, you know, the purpose that you, the passion that comes with doing something that you're really driven about, is so rewarding. And I also wanted to just give more credit to my mom and my sister and my team of assistants who do so much, to support the business, and I couldn't do it without them. So wanted to give more props there and just share that I'm feeling so much better if, you know, anyone was super concerned, which I'm sure no one was. And perhaps it's the perfectionist in me that even had to clarify that and say anything at all. But, you know, that's who I am. I'm working on it. That's why we had Victoria Albina on our podcast to talk about codependency, perfectionism, people-pleasing, these behaviors and thought patterns that so many of us can relate to. And we dig in deep, and she shares so much insightful information and strategies with us, which we can't wait for you to hear. So more about Victoria. She is a certified life coach, UCSF trained family nurse practitioner, and breathwork meditation guide with a passion for helping women realize that they are their own best healers so they can break free from codependency, perfectionism, and people-pleasing and reclaim their joy. She is the host of the Feminist Wellness Podcast, holds a master's degree in public health from Boston University School of Public Health, and a BA in Latin American Studies from Oberlin College. Victoria has been working in health and wellness for over 20 years and lives on occupied Munsee Lenape territory in New York's Hudson Valley. So in this episode, we get into codependency. She defines it for us. She talks about how it can show up in different ways beyond what you might think. It's not just a toxic relationship with another partner necessarily. How codependency relates to perfectionism. I share my struggles with perfectionism, and Victoria shares some wonderful techniques for breaking through the control and fear that can be related to perfectionist thinking. We get into the vagus nervous system and somatic practices that Victoria suggests to bring you into a more calm state of mind. Super interesting, not something that we've talked about before. We talk about what's at root of people-pleasing, and we really dive into ways to maintain friendships or address relationships that may not be serving you. So to break that down further, Specifically, we talk about communication strategies for addressing friendships that maybe you've been in for a really long time, maybe from childhood, but you've drifted apart. And then we talk about communication strategies for acquaintances, people that you can't really make time for, but you want to, you know, acknowledge them. And then friendships that are really not building you up, aren't serving you, aren't positive in your life. So it'll be more clear when you listen, of course, but Jess and I share some really personal experiences related to friendships and relationships, and her advice is super helpful for moving on with clarity and honesty for yourself and for the benefit of the other person. So we are going to do a part two with Victoria in July. We've actually already picked the date because she is so awesome, and we didn't get to dig into more of the health impacts of some of these behaviors and thought patterns, specifically the impact on our gut, on our adrenal health. And we also really want to expand on the conversation around codependency and specifically codependent relationships, how to break free from maybe a toxic relationship, but also communication strategies that might be helpful in different kinds of codependent relationships. That could be a friendship as well. So that is what's to come. We really hope you stick around. And of course, if you're loving what you're hearing, enjoying it, it means so much. And it really helps us grow and bring on more great guests. If you can leave us a review, if you haven't already, rate, review, and subscribe in the iTunes app. That really is just amazing for us to see when we get a new review. And then, of course, we're going to be back in 2 weeks with a new solo episode. Jess and I are going to be sharing our fertility journey. So we hope you come back for that and enjoy the rest of your day, night, weekend, week, wherever you are. Thanks for listening.
Hello, this is Victoria.
Hi, Victoria. This is Ryan and Jess with the Solo Pod.
Oh my goodness, how great to hear from you.
Thank you so much for joining us today as our expert on all things codependency, perfectionism, people pleasing. We have so many questions for you, and I was personally so ready to have you on our podcast because when your publicist reached out and shared the pitch, it was like everything that you specialize in is something that I'm currently still struggling with or have kind of overcome, but you know how things can come back,
sure.
You know, gut issues, all of that. And so,
yeah.
So although the focus of this episode will really be on these behaviors and patterns that you specialize in and how to help people break the cycle, and also how these behaviors like people pleasing, perfectionism can impact our health, we always like to start by hearing from our experts about their early experiences. You know, what led you to become an expert in this realm, and how, what were you like as a young girl? We know you immigrated from Argentina at a young age. So how did that impact your personality? And just tell us a little bit about your early experiences that led to ultimately to this work and this passion.
Yeah. So my gateway into doing this work was through the gut. So I had wicked gut issues my whole life growing up. And I will translate that. That's hella gut issues for the West Coast. Just want to make sure we start off with a little respect.
With some clarity. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a little respect, inclusivity.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. While the whole world isn't Rhode Island, it should be. But yeah. Anyway, I had wicked gut issues and couldn't get the help I wanted and needed. I was diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome, which as a functional medicine nurse practitioner, I will say is just a garbage can diagnosis that means absolutely nothing and gets you no help. So being the total nerd I am, now I'm bragging again, started with bragging about being from Rhode Island. Now I'm bragging on being a nerd. I got to studying and I realized that I needed to be my own clinician. I needed to find the answers that no one was providing for me. So I became a nurse practitioner, an herbalist. I studied functional medicine, and my brain is one that sees patterns. It always has. And in working in health and wellness for so long, I started to see these patterns in my patients, particularly those with chronic GI issues, issues like hypothyroid, Hashimoto's, reproductive health issues, this issue around mindset, around chronically putting ourselves last, mm-hmm. around caring more what other people think about us than we do ourselves and what we want and what we need. And I started to see that there was so much codependent, perfectionist, and people-pleasing thinking going on for myself and for my patients. And so I started diving in and I started studying psychology, really nerding out on human behavior and learning more and more about why we do the things we do. And that led me to polyvagal theory, to studying the nervous system, to studying somatics. I studied sensory motor psychotherapy as a coach. And I started bringing coaching into my medical practice, into my clinic. And I started doing the deep dive questions we do in advanced coaching to start to see what my patients were thinking and how that correlated with their symptoms, while at the same time applying that same learning, that same knowledge to my own life. My gut health, my thyroid, my adrenals, everything improved, my mental health, chronic pain, as I started to look at the ways I was thinking about myself, the world, my relationships. And I will caveat here, because it's really easy in the like hashtag spiritual, hashtag wellness world to make it sound like mindset is literally everything. It's a big part of it. I also had a parasite. Like I had blastocystis hominis that needed to be found and murdered. Mindset work alone would not have done it. But I couldn't stay well after killing the parasite until I did the mindset work, because it's part and parcel of doing nervous system work. So as I worked on myself, I brought that into clinic and I saw my clients and my patients, I saw their lives change radically. And eventually it was really what I wanted to focus my life on. So I closed my medical practice. I had a private practice in Manhattan, closed that and dedicated myself to coaching full time.
Wow. Well, there are so many strategies and techniques we know you share with your clients that we want to dig into more. But to go back even further to your own experiences and just in general, you know, I know so much of this comes back to our early childhood experiences and our inner child and our voice that kind of carries through until we kind of break the patterns or rewrite the script. So how, you know, can you share with us maybe some early experiences that impacted your personality or your behavior that led to some of these traits?
Totally. I never really felt like I fit in. I was like gregarious, but lonely, like everyone's sort of like casual friend, but didn't really understand how to make deep friendships and deep connections. And I think that's, you know, that's a huge part of what happens in codependent thinking, is because the way I define codependent thinking is as chronically sourcing our sense of worth, wellness, and validation from everyone and everything in the world instead of from within us. And so that's what leads us to try to keep everyone happy with us. It leads us to shapeshift, to chameleon, to pretend to be someone we're not, to like play this part and live from a false self. And now with hindsight, I can absolutely say that I was completely doing that. I didn't feel safe and secure being myself. I didn't believe that my authentic self was lovable. And so I showed up as the person I thought everyone else wanted me to be, which strengthened the thinking, which strengthened showing up as my false self, because I would get accolades and atta girls and you're awesome for that. And the cycle just continued and continued. Mm.
Wow, that's really profound how you defined codependency, because I've never heard it defined like that. And I think that that's like a major light bulb moment for me personally, because I can relate to you. I've been in a codependent relationship before, but I never thought about it being beyond just like that intimate romantic relationship of like, wow, you know, back in my crazy yo-yo diet days, like I was always seeking validation from other people. Like I need to know like what to do from your perspective, you know, like, what do I need to eat? Like, how should I move my body? Like, can I do this? Can I do that? Is that okay? And never really trusting myself to make choices that felt good within my own body. So feeling very disconnected from my body and not tuning in, which is now something that I practice and preach all the time of like, well, your body's constantly sending you messages if you are fatigued and bloated after eating that one food, just because that expert told you to eat it, maybe it doesn't work for you. Right. So I feel like we see that a lot in the wellness world. And I'm kind of curious, like your perspective on that or how you've seen that manifest.
Yeah, honestly, it's one of the main reasons I got out of practicing medicine was that I felt that I was being put in this guru guide role that I am not comfortable with. I'm no one's God and no one's guru. I know a lot, but I don't know you. I don't know your body. And it feels really paternalistic and is deeply rooted in the patriarchy and a white settler colonialist framework for living versus an intersectional feminist framework for living. Because it really posits that, again, someone else knows, like you so beautifully said, what you should eat.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I no longer wanted to be a part of that system in which people were coming into clinic and literally saying exactly what you just said. Like, what you said, that apples are good for my SIBO. Well, they're not great for SIBO. The apples are great for my heartburn. But like, if I eat an apple, I feel like crap and I'm exhausted for 2 days, but I should eat them. Right. And I'm like, oh, honey, no.
Yeah.
No, no, no.
And they're like, oh, and it's okay that I feel like crap. I'll keep eating it if that's what you tell me to do.
If that's what you want. Right. So people were coming into clinic, seeing me, like projecting whatever issues were up around attachment from their childhood onto me, right? They were putting me in the role of their mom, of their dad, of their caregiver, and were trying to seek my approval, my validation, as though that was the thing that would save them and finally give them like some magic key to feeling better. And I want to name, like, it's not their fault. It's not our fault. I know I did it too, right? We've been taught, we've been trained, we've been socialized and conditioned to look outside of ourselves for expertise instead of looking within.
Mm-hmm. How would you help people understand if they have codependent behaviors? Because there's, I'm sure, levels to that.
Oh, sure.
And extremes. Yeah. And then, you know, we'll start there and then I'll.
No, it's for sure a spectrum. And I'm really glad that you named that because people often feel like, well, if I'm not in this relationship where I'm enabling someone with substance use issues, then like I'm not really codependent enough to get help. And I think it really keeps a lot of people, particularly human socialized as women, from getting the care, the support, the coaching that we want and need so we can live the lives that we want to live, joyful, vibrant, happy lives. So how does someone know if they have codependent thinking? Well, if that definition I shared resonates for you, if you're constantly looking outside of yourself, whether it's another diploma, another degree, another certificate, another class, whether it's another relationship, being married, having a certain job, having the right number of kids, the right kind of house, like if you are looking for someone or something outside of you to evidence to you that you are worthy of love and care. If you think I have to be a certain weight, I have to look a certain way, wear a certain size, right? If this is the framework through which you live your life, then perhaps you are dependent on a system outside of yourself instead of really looking inward. And I think it's really important to name too that folks who identify as super hyper independent have often swung to the other side of codependent. And I would still place them within this framework where their sense of safety and wellness is dependent on relationship with others. In this case, guarding themselves from those relationships.
Do you think that it just kind of got the wheels spinning that imposter syndrome can kind of be enmeshed with that? Because I feel like sometimes when you feel like what you said about degrees, like if you're on a path to become a coach or become a doctor or whatever it is, and you start to see all these other people who feel like they're light years ahead of you.
Right.
And then it's like, in order to be smart enough or be ready enough, then you need to get another degree, need to get another accolade. You need to talk to more people. And I just wonder if like those kind of personality types go together at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first I would say, I don't think of them as personality
okay,
types,
yes.
but like just it's conditioning, right? It's survival skills right. From childhood. And in this case, when we're talking about imposter syndrome, it can be a symptom of an experience of a codependent framework for living. And I mean, it's kind of imperative in capitalism, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Like yeah. we're really taught, like, you got to do the next thing. You got to get the next shiny gold star and the next gold medal and the next A+ to be worthy.
Trusting yourself and knowing that you're already capable and, you know, you can go out there and you can fail and that's okay. And that's a part of learning and growing. But then again, that also comes back to a bit of perfectionism too. So it seems like it's all kind of interconnected in some way.
Yeah. And I would say the question to ask yourself is why? Why do I want the next degree? Why do I want to be dating someone? Why do I want to gain 5 pounds, lose 5 pounds? Why do I want to do whatever it is I feel that urge to do? And from there, do I like my reasons why?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because like I'm taking the next level of sensory motor psychotherapy training. Do I need it? No. Do I think it'll be really fun because I'm a nerd and I love to learn stuff? Absolutely. Am I going to advertise it on my website in the hopes that people will think I'm now good enough? No. I don't think my website even says I've trained in sensory motor.
Yeah.
But I want to do it for me. And I love that reason why.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's so different.
Yeah, totally.
I want to dig into the connection with perfectionism because I wouldn't say that I've thought of perfectionism as being related to codependency before. So can you explain that connection? And I'd love to share some of my sort of my type of perfectionism, because in many ways, the codependency that you described doesn't sound like me, but yet I am a perfectionist. So it's helpful to kind of, you know, we're also different to see, anyway, yes.
Yeah, totally. So when perfectionism is coming from codependent thinking, and maybe just in general, actually, it's really about attempting to control how safe we feel by attempting to control how others see us, right? So if I show up in this absolutely perfect way and I do it just right and it's the most best, then no one can come for me. No one can say I'm not worthy. No one can say I'm not lovable. No one can make me unsafe because I've gone above and beyond to prove my worthiness, to prove my goodness.
I feel like that's major because even a simple, I guess, stupid comparison, but it really comes to my mind is like posting on social media as a brand or a business or an influencer and overthinking the posts. Mm. Like I have a current client who does this all the time, who's becoming a health coach. And she's just like, I keep writing these posts and then just feeling like, does anyone care? Why am I writing this? I don't know. What are people like? What if no one posts, you know, likes it or says anything? And then I'm embarrassed because it didn't get engagement. And, you know, she is a perfectionist because she always wants everything to be perfect and doesn't think that it ever is.
Right.
And then also is afraid to hit publish because of potentially how it will be responded. So then your definition of codependency is like, well, you're seeking that outside validation versus just knowing what you have to say is even if it hits one person, like it came from your heart. And as long as you know that you're serving other people and that it was authentic for you, like that's really all that should matter.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you 100%. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, Riot, it would be cool for you to kind of share, like you were saying, what you have experienced, you know, with perfectionism, because I do see that in Riot a lot. And I am not necessarily that way. Although just in hearing you describe the codependency definition, I feel that I've had more of that, of like the people pleasing and the codependency, whereas Rye is very much like never thinks that anything that she does is perfect. And she even told me once, well, I don't think I'm a perfectionist because nothing I do is perfect. And I was like, that's why you're a perfectionist.
Yeah.
There it is.
There it
is. I read an article recently that struck a chord. It was about different types of perfectionism, which I'm curious if you subscribe to that belief or idea that there's sort of the self-driven perfectionist, the perfectionist, which I would categorize myself in that way, that I am only competing with myself and sort of these high standards that I set for myself. You know, especially with writing, editing things that, you know, I went to school for, or, you know, and it's,
it's just never, it could always be things you can tinker with forever and they can always be better. There's so many examples of that, but I would put myself in that category. Then they talked about other perfectionism where you're trying to be perfect for others, or am I getting that wrong? What was it? It was, socially driven perfectionism. You're trying to be perfect to be socially seen as perfect or admirable. And then the third was other perfectionism, where you actually are expecting other people to fit your definition of perfect. So you're actually, and that was so interesting because I think in many ways, perfectionism can be actually beneficial for my work product.
Sure.
And having, you know, wanting to put out the highest quality, but obviously I know the pitfalls and I want to break that habit of just spending too long on things. But yeah, are you familiar with these different types? What are your thoughts on that? And when can perfectionism really be a good thing, or can it be?
To the latter point, can perfectionism be a good thing? I think striving to do our best is always a beautiful thing. But the problem with perfectionism is that nothing's ever perfect.
Yeah.
So I think, like you said, it does eventually, we shoot ourselves in the foot, right? And we end up procrastinating. We end up not actually getting started because we put so much pressure on ourselves to do it perfectly, right? To meet an absolutely unattainable standard for a human being. Right. So I get what you're saying. Like, I want to do it really well, but there's a difference between really well, really good, and perfect.
Yeah.
Right. Cause what's ever perfect?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are some of like the fundamental practices that you would have, you know, someone put into practice that is trying to heal from perfectionism, but maybe like with Rye has a whole business to run and there's endless things to do. And we do need to be putting out high quality products. And honestly, everything that Rye does is amazing. And she catches like the littlest mistakes that I don't see and is just so passionate about everything she does. And I think that comes with perfectionists sometimes, like they're very passionate. And so, yeah, I'm just wondering, what are some of those techniques that you might work with someone like her on in a way that's comfortable, that doesn't feel, you know, overwhelming?
So the first two things that come to mind, one is to recognize and begin to really trust and believe that you always do A-plus work. And so from there, from building that trust, to ask yourself what I'm going to go for A-minus work. I usually go for B-plus, but I think that might actually give you some type of coronary event. And to even think about that, don't want to call 911 during this conversation. So
she got straight A's in high school.
Oh, I know she did. Yeah, I know. She was like that above 4.0, right?
Yeah. No.
But 4.1 million.
4.0.
My parents were like, oh my God, Jess got a B and put it on the fridge. And they're like celebrating. Rye's like, well, I always get straight A's. What about me?
Yeah. So trusting that, right? Trusting and believing that, and then asking yourself, what does my A minus look like? And then coming into belief that your A minus is more than good enough. Because I bet your A minus is like so amazing, so incredible, so beautiful. And your A minus could save you hours, so much time, so much effort, so much emotional energy, so much stress, right? Because done and dusted and out the door is so much better than staying up till 3 a.m. to make it the A plus perfect, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting combo with Jess and I working together because she does really, really great quality work too, but she's able to bust things out.
Right.
And then kind of get them to me to refine, edit, whatever. But, you know, I do struggle with when to let things just be done and move on. And so, you know, what I'm hearing is it doesn't have to be your best work every single time or the absolute all-star. Like, what are you, you're not winning an award here, you know, learning to, I think, delegate as well. I would be curious your thoughts on that. Because I think a lot of areas that take too much time are the areas that I need to just not be involved with that, right. You know, at a certain point, it's like, I'm going to spend 10 hours on this and Jess can do it in two. So is that something that you help people with too, in delegating and, you know, asking for help?
Yeah, absolutely. Part and parcel of the codependent thought habit is really feeling so out of control because we don't trust our worth that we want to control everyone and everything around us. Everything we put out has to be perfect, right? Because then we feel a sense of control. Everyone has to like it because then we feel a sense of control. And we have to do everything our goddamn selves. So we make sure it's done perfectly. Mm-hmm. So the people shall be pleased, right? And so it's really challenging for us to loosen up the reins and to let someone else in to help us, right? Whether it's about delegating at work, delegating at home, or to help us emotionally, right? To let folks see that it turns out we're just human beings and we're not these like perfect machines that can do all the things all the time without rest. Mm-hmm. And so learning to delegate is really about learning to trust yourself, that you will be okay. You will have your back if you let go of just a little tiny smidge of control and build from there.
Yeah.
Are there any, I know I read that you specialize in somatics.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that and any other strategies for really moving through some of this control or fear, yeah, whatever it might be, through the body and being able to move along and move, yes, on?
Absolutely. And that was when you asked about perfectionism, I said two thoughts. It like just came back to me because we kept going. It was perfect. So the first was A minus work, B plus for the rest of us, but A minus for Rye. Maybe just maybe head for B minus.
Yeah, I'm cool with that. I'm cool
like
with
done.
That.
You're, yeah, good. All right. Yeah. Cool. So really taking a quality look at those standards and asking again, why do I need it to be the A plus? And from there, learning to map our nervous system. So this brings us back around to your question about somatics. So really coming into an understanding of the state our nervous system is in at any given moment, understanding that, as we say in the nervous system world, story follows state. So the thoughts we have about ourselves, our work, the world, whatever we're working on, are directly influenced by the state of our nervous system in that given moment. So when we can understand the basics of polyvagal theory and how the nervous system works, and can then ask ourselves, what state am I in? And can then get really grounded in the things that support each of our individual nervous systems, we create so much space for growth and expansion from that embodied self-knowledge.
How do you know what state, yeah, you're in?
Yeah. I would like to nerd out hard. So yeah. I'm curious, do you have your safety goggles on? What about pocket protector? Like, are we ready?
I am ready.
Nerd so hard. Okay, great. Here we go, darlings. So polyvagal theory is the work of Dr. Stephen Porges. And it's the theory that helps us to understand that the nervous system has three main states that are part of two branches of the autonomic nervous system, controlled by the vagus nerve, which is the 10th cranial nerve, the longest nerve in the human body. And it innervates or gives nerve function to pretty much the entire animal. So your cognition, your thyroid, your diaphragm, your heart and lungs, your digestion, reproductive function. Remember back to when we started and I talked about all the things that get messed up in codependent thinking, in stress, distress, and trauma, circle back around to the vagus nerve, right? And so that's part of why it's key to bringing in profound, deep, and sustainable healing. So the vagus nerve has these two main parts, the sympathetic nervous system, which most of us have heard of, that's fight or flight, freak out, foot is all the way on the gas, you're revved up, the engine is going, you're full of adrenaline, norepinephrine, cortisol, stress, right? And so what your body thinks is a lion is chasing me. But what really happened is that your ex posted a picture on Instagram with their new partner and your body's like, ah, I'm dying. I'm being chased by a lion. Shut it down. Freak out. Anxiety, worry, stress. Or you have a deadline or you're trying to get the A+. Stress. Then there's parasympathetic, which is made up of two parts, ventral vagus, which is our steady state that is safe and social. Your foot, if you've heard of nervous system regulation, what we're talking about is how much foot is on the gas, how much foot is on the brake. So in ventral vagus, you've got just enough gas to get going and just enough brake to not freak out about it. And then you can be safe, you can be social, you can connect with people. That's the state my nervous system is in right now, talking to the two of you, we're making eye contact, we're smiling, we're connecting. 3 years ago when I was doing these interviews, I was totally insympathetic because I wasn't as grounded in myself and my message, right? So I had more adrenaline. I don't have it now because I have more comfort. The body will stay in ventral vagus connected until it gets triggered or activated to go into sympathetic, to escape something dangerous, or to fight off a predator. If that doesn't work, or the body has tried doing that for years and years and years, and it didn't work, and the body's kind of like, I'm out of gas here, then it goes into the third part, which is dorsal. So dorsal vagus is the freeze response. That is foot fully on the brake, fully off the gas. It's when you're not really connected in with your life force energy. You just feel drained. You feel tired. I don't know. I don't want to talk to anybody. I'm just in dorsal. I just want to like lie on the couch and like veg and like, not like a deciding to veg, but more like I'm just checked out. Like I'm done.
Depression.
Like depression.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anxiety tends to be more of a sympathetic state and depression goes with dorsal. In animals, we see this as a possum playing possum or a deer in the headlights, just being, I'm not even here. Hmm. In that state, the body downregulates pain response in case you're being attacked, right? The body thinks you're under attack. Hmm. So when we start to map our nervous system, we start to see where we naturally head to, what our home away from home is. When I was younger, I would get anxious. I would get revved up. I would get worried. I would get about things and would head to overwhelm quickly. And in time, and this is what happens for many of us, that system got exhausted and my body tends to go towards dorsal more. Towards like checking out in conflict. And I have a lot of skills to support myself and regulate my nervous system so I don't go all the way to there. But I can feel that my nervous system starts to be like, okay, I'm just, okay, fine, you're right. And when I was in a very codependent relationship, that was my go-to, right? Was to like show my tender underbelly and just be like, you're right. It's okay. I must be wrong. Okay. And so when we know where we are, we know what thoughts we have access to. Right? Because you're not going to be able to manage your mind and to use a tool like thought work to manage a mind that a body that's in sympathetic. So if you're all revved up and you're like, I am calm. Your body's like, what the no? Like, dude, there is a lion chasing you. Can you fucking run already? Like, what is going on here? It's not going to work. And anyone who's been depressed on the couch and is like, all right, kiddo, get up, just get up. Get going, get motivated.
Yeah.
Once again, your body's like, yo, have you not been living here for 30 years or whatever? Do you not understand that we are collapsed, that I am trying to protect you right now? Mm. So when we understand our state, we know how to talk to ourselves. We know how to be in conversation with ourselves, mind, body, and spirit. And then we can use tools like thought work to begin to change our mindset. But first, we have to use somatic practices, body-based methods, so we can get anchored in ourselves and we can understand our nervous system and we can understand what our minds, our bodies, our spirits need.
So wow. What would be some examples of breath work or other somatics that you use with clients?
So the somatic practices I use are really about getting in touch with felt sensation. So many of us, and particularly folks with codependent habits, we live from the neck up. right? We're in our head spinning and spinning and overthinking and over worrying and stressing out in our thoughts all day long, all lifetime, really. And so we've become so disconnected from this felt experience of being us that, you know, like a decade ago, when I was a primary care provider, maybe like 8 years ago, I was so disconnected from my body and was so driven to succeed and really get that A plus at work that I gave myself a kidney infection by not peeing when I had to. Right. I'd just be like, I have to be on time. I have to see the next patient. I don't want them to wait. I want them to like me. I want to get a good review. I want them to like, give me 5 stars on Yelp. Right. Like I'm not going to, I'll pee later. I'll pee later. I'll pee later. I'll pee later until I was like hospitalized.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is not uncommon. Right. We put our bodily impulses to eat, to pee, to drink water, to rest. Right. We put them last. And we put the demands of capitalism and our jobs and our lives ahead, other people's wants and needs ahead of ours. So really slowing things down. So much of somatic practice is about slowing things down, right? We feel a sensation in our body and we jump to meaning making instead of sitting with it. We feel an emotion and we jump to trying to change it instead of witnessing and allowing it first. Mm-hmm. So we witness it. We allow it, and only then do we take action, whether it's thought work, breath work, or a somatic practice to change it. So one really simple, really accessible somatic practice that folks can do, and I love this practice because it's really useful when you're both in sympathetic and in dorsal. Oh, another one came to mind. Okay, so two great exercises we can do. I also love somatics because it's free, right? Like it's about you being with your body, you being present for your body. Again, no God, no guru needed. Mm-hmm. You just get to know yourself. So here are the two practices. The first is to take your hands. If you have access to both hands, if both work or both are functional and can move, if just one hand can move, great. If you don't have the ability to move either hand, you can picture them in your mind. So you take your thumb and you touch it to your first finger and say one, your second finger and say two, your ring finger and say three, your pinky and say four. And so if you're in sympathetic and you're revved up, you can do this really, 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 really slowly, like annoyingly slowly. So it could go one, two, three, four. And then from your pinky, go back four, three, two, one, and just keep going till your nervous system gets the signal that it's safe to calm down. Because an animal that's moving slowly, deliberately, intentionally is not one that's in danger, right? So when you're revved up and you slow down, that's the signal your nervous system gets from you. Now, if you're in dorsal and you're like, I need a little pick-me-up energy. I need a little motivation energy. I'm really checked out in this conversation. I want to be present with my partner to talk about this issue in our relationship. And it feels really hard for my nervous system to stay online. First of all, excuse yourself to the bathroom. Take a moment for yourself. And one of the things you can do is that same exercise, but a little faster. So when we're moving from dorsal towards ventral vagus, so from freeze into safe and social, we want to be gentle, right? So you can actually overwhelm your nervous system if you bring in too much activation energy, which is why I don't like ice baths. I don't like an ice cold shower. I don't like those kind of things when we're in dorsal, right? That's, we don't need a huge cathartic bolt of sympathetic activation. It's too much for the nervous system. Yeah, thank you. So, but you can take your thumb to your first finger and go one, two, three, four, four, three, two, one, one, two, three, four, and just keep going till you start to feel a little movement, little activation, a little more get up and go, and go as fast or slow as you need, but do start gently. And then the next exercise is one of my favorites. So it's called This Is My Arm. And again, it's variable. If you need to calm the nervous system, come down from sympathetic, you might gently stroke your arm and say out loud, if you can, this is my arm. It's also a really beautiful reclamation of the body. This is my arm. This is my arm. The other thing that happens in stress, distress, and trauma, and when we're activated in a response, in an old nervous system response, is that our body forgets who, what, when, where, and why we are. And we're shunted back into that moment in childhood when someone yelled at us, that moment in childhood where we tried to express our feelings and we were negated, right? That moment in childhood when. And so we bring the nervous system back into the here and now by orienting to our environment. Means simply looking around and getting present to where you are and getting present to your own body with a practice like this is my arm can be so helpful. This is my arm. And so then if you're feeling really dorsal and shut down, you can pat. So you can pat your arm and say, this is my arm. This is my arm. This is my arm, right? And you can go to your hands. You can go to your chest. You can pat your face. You can do your thighs. You're like, just do your whole body until you feel yourself. Okay, I'm coming back. I'm coming back into myself. I'm getting grounded once more. I'm getting present here and now with me in this time, this space, this moment. And I honor that my nervous system thought I wasn't safe, like 10 seconds ago, 1 second ago. And I get to remind me, I'm safe right now. I'm okay. Everything's fine. I'm okay. That's good. Yeah.
Super helpful. Thank you.
And my pleasure.
I feel like I can really relate to just operating at that high speed and just trying to get so much done in every day and maximizing every hour. And I've been developing, I mean, there's so much that I don't think we're going to get to today in the gut territory and how these, you know, behaviors can impact our gut. But I've always had gut issues pretty much my entire life, but recently a new thing is like this acid reflux.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's gotta be stress related because, it just feels like it's connected to a lack of slowing down and breathing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Do you want me to give you the 2 second nerd on that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So our bodily systems, those controlled by the vagus nerve, which we went over are most of them, they work optimally when we're in ventral vagus. So if you think about it logically, Rye, if you were being chased by a lion, would you want your body to expend energy, caloric capacity, right? Like, would you want your body to break down a cheeseburger? Or do you want it to be focused on shunting the blood to your legs to run and your fists to punch?
Yeah. Focused.
Get me out of there.
Yeah, get me the hell out of here. What are we doing? Let's run. And so too in dorsal, if you're hiding at the back of the cave, and I remember dorsal, so your back is against the door of the cave trying to keep the world out. You want to break down a cheeseburger? Or you want to focus on being small and quiet and looking dead? Right? So yeah, digestion slows down. The migrating motor complex in the small intestine, which is the electromagnetic impulse that moves food through the small intestine and then into the large intestine, it practically stops when we're under stress, right? So folks with heartburn, with SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth, any kind of digestive issue, stress inherently plays a role. Right. With heartburn, I'd get checked for Helicobacter pylori as well and other bacteria, right? Like do your stool test, get it figured out. Right. And I think you're right on to look at the role of slowing down because our gut needs that. Our digestion needs that signaling from us so that it knows it's safe to digest a cheeseburger.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you said that because just thinking back to like all the different diets and protocols that Rye has tried to get relief. And even that I've tried for different things. I feel like so often it's like, we're hyper vigilant about our food and get obsessed about like, I can't have this. Otherwise it's going to flare up my SIBO or my migraine or my acid reflux. Like I'm not allowed to have this. And then that adds stress. Oof. And we're focused so much all the time on how we're eating or what we're eating when really we need to focus more on how we're eating, which is why I'm such a big proponent and advocate of mindful eating practices where you take a meal away from distractions. And I know that that's something that Rye does too.
So helpful.
Has helped her a lot. And so, yeah, I'm wondering if that's something that you incorporate into your practice or your daily life and what changes you've seen with your clients.
No, that was a huge, and it was really always interesting to watch New Yorkers get frustrated when I wouldn't tell them what to eat, but I'd ask like, hey, do you chew your food? And they'd be like, of course I, wait a sec. I don't chew my food. I eat it like sitting at my desk while typing an email. I eat it on the 6 train. I eat it running around town. Like I don't chew. Right. Meaning I'm not in ventral vagus when I'm eating, which is like, how can you expect the pyloric sphincter in your stomach to actually open and close appropriately if it's not getting that ventral vagal signaling? Like, because science, it's not going to work optimally. So I'm with you, Jess. Like, mindful eating practices are absolutely huge. And I think we can go a step beyond that and ask, are we living mindfully? Are we in relationship mindfully? Who are we eating with? And are we still married to them because we like them or because we don't want our parents to think poorly of us, right? Are we at dinner with this friend because we really like her and want her company and enjoy spending time? Or are we with her because from our codependent thinking and our people pleasing, we're conflict averse and we're scared to say no and we don't want to upset her. We don't want her to like feel bad. So we'd rather feel bad. Mm.
So true.
That is something I wanted to move into next, because obviously there's this connection between all of this perfectionism, people pleasing, but I saw some of your social posts about how fear of rejection can so often be at root of people pleasing. Can you expand upon that?
Yeah. I mean, let's be really real about it. It's human. It's mammalian to want to be liked, right? If you think about it, our nervous systems are so attuned to safety and we want to do everything in our power as pack animals to ensure that when the lions come, when the marauders come to take over our village, that someone bigger and faster than us, who likes us, who approves of us, who thinks we're a good girl, is going to put us on our hip and run like hell, right? They're going to save us. So I just worry, you know, people, I've seen so many of my clients beating themselves up for caring what other people think. And I just want to start by reminding everyone, like, you're a mammal, you're a human, it's normal, it's natural. But what becomes problematic is when you care more about what other people think than you care about your own opinion. When you care more about whether they like you than you care about if you like you. Right. And if you care more about how they view you than you care about living in your authenticity, living as your actual self. Yeah.
It's interesting because I recently had, I've gone from most of my life not having any friendship drama in any way to having like several things recently where it's like, whoa, I can't stop thinking about it, you know, especially at night. And then that affects my sleeping. And, I had a dinner with my close friends recently, and they really helped me just kind of wake up about it because it was something that had been going on for a while. A couple relationships with people that just had given me a lot of red flags in terms of how they treated me, how they, or didn't, you know, weren't mindful of my feelings in difficult relationships. And, you know, and just being, and still yet, like one of these people was coming to visit and still yet wanting to meet up and say, yes, I'll meet with you because you asked me, even though I'm sharing with them that this person has made me feel not so great. And that I'm really not sure I want to pursue this friendship, you know?
Yeah.
And they were just like, Ryan, can you just focus on the friendships and all of these people in your life that love you so much and just know your value and know that you don't need any of these people, you don't need anybody extra. Like you have enough people in your life and focus on your value and, you know, what you believe and, you know, goodbye to the rest. And it seems so obvious, but it just, in that moment, it really was like a light bulb switch for me where I was just like, right. And even someone was like, you're being kind of fake by saying you'll meet up and saying, and continuing this, yet you're telling us that you're pretty over it and that you're not
you know, feeling good about it. So why are you keeping on the cycle?
Yeah. I mean, I think the reason we keep on the cycle is because one of our inner children, some voice from our childhood, tells us that we are obliged to do things we don't want to do. And I think this is particularly for humans socialized as women. We do the dishes after dinner, even when the boys and the men go watch TV or go play, right? We stay in the kitchen and help mom, but I don't want to, but you need to, right? We are told that there's so much that's incumbent upon us to do to be acceptable, and that we live from obligation. And so many of us saw this modeled for us by our mothers and their mothers and their mothers, because they were trained in the patriarchy to do this. And so they passed that wounding on to us. And so I'm glad those friends helped you. And I want to bring a little extra compassion in here for you to say, like, you were just doing what you were trained to do, which is to keep other people happy, which is a good girl's job.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like with, you know, my fiance and a lot of men and that I've been around, that they don't feel the need to explain,
yep,
you know, or just,
oh yeah,
I didn't. Yeah. We're just not friends. Like, move on, get over it, or whatever. Yeah. And it's so hard to do. And, not to hog the conversation here, but I saw another post you had shared about conflict and leaning into addressing things with people.
Yeah.
But that's actually something that I've always done. Like, I have always been a huge proponent of communication, of addressing anything when there's an issue. Yeah. I do not shy away from it. I like to address it. But recently, with these situations, I realized I have this need to address it and talk through it with them. And actually, that's probably not what's best for me in this situation. You got to let that relationship go, because reaching out, continuing the back and forth is just going to stir up more drama, more emotions, rather than just saying, you know, there's a time to just let it go.
Right. I mean, one of the things we do from codependent thinking is we over-justify and over-explain, or even justify and explain things that need neither.
Yeah.
Right. Because again, it comes back to the worthiness. Right. So if you're that cis dude who's just like, nope, I don't want to be friends, peace. And you just trust that because you've been trained since birth to trust yourself in the patriarchy, then you're just like, whatever. But if you've been socialized and trained to not trust yourself, then, like, of course, you're like, well, you know, Molly, it's like, it's not that I don't like think you're wonderful. And it's not that, like, I don't appreciate you. I think you're amazing. It's just that, like, I don't know, I'm doing other things and, like, I don't really have time for this, but, like, I love you and I think you're so great. You know what I mean? And you're pretty and you're smart. And, right?
And actually, yeah. I do want to be friends. Just kidding.
Yeah. Just kidding.
Get together JK. Next week.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to totally abandon myself.
Clear my schedule right now.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, because I've dealt with this too. Like, people pleasing is something that I have battled with my whole life. And I think a lot of that comes down to the fear of not being liked.
Sure.
And getting bad feedback or whatever, maybe thinking about someone talking badly about you behind your back.
Right.
And so, yeah. And not wanting to hurt other people's feelings, because potentially that could mean that you're hurting them and they hurt you back.
Right.
And so if you do come to this place where you're like, okay, this friendship just isn't serving me. They don't, maybe we've been childhood friends, you know, for 20 years, but like, why are we still friends now? You know, or
we
do have a history and there are these qualities about them that I like, but at the end of the day, they're causing stress that's making me sick and I'm staying up till midnight obsessing over what I'm going to say to them. How do we kind of, and I know this is a big question, but step away from those sort of toxic relationships without having to have a really deep conversation? Because sometimes it comes down to like fundamental differences in just who you are as a person. And so to communicate to somebody like, I just don't like your personality, you know, or like,
or how do you communicate
how, that? Yeah. That's what I'm saying is like, how do you communicate that? Or do you not? And like move on from a friendship because maybe you've outgrown it and it's just not healthy anymore.
There's so many parts to that. Yeah. Well, some of the things that come to mind are to really be gently direct and to the point. And to really keep the focus on yourself. And that you're making the best choice for you. Because I don't think we need to sort of drag anyone through the mud.
Right.
If it's what you said, right. If there's been harm, if there's been something to address that you want to speak and to have a conversation about, that's one thing. But if, like you said, it's just your values no longer align. And like you went to middle school together, but now you're wildly different animals. Gentle, kind words that state what you want in your life would be the best way to go, in my opinion, right? Like, poor Molly. Why am I keep picking on Molly? But anyway, Molly, it's funny. One of my favorite people from growing up is named Molly Lederer. Hello, Molly Lederer. I think you're phenomenal and amazing. I hope you're having a beautiful day. But Molly, I have loved being friends with you, and I'm not available anymore to keep hanging out. And I look forward to seeing you at our high school reunion or whatever is true. Mm-hmm. Cause we don't want to BS either. Right.
Yeah.
But if you don't hate Molly, you're just like, I don't want to keep doing happy hour with Molly and like hearing about like whatever that I is not supportive in my life. That doesn't serve me. Just gently letting her know that you're not available to hang out. I mean, those are three of my favorite words. I'm not available.
Yeah. That feels so hard for me to say, but I just, even just saying that feels hurtful. Like, cause I could see that being received as like, oh, so you're just not available to hang out cause you don't like me. And I mean, I get what you're saying. And I wish that I could be more direct in that sense. Like, I do feel like there are people in my life where we've just grown apart. Yeah. And them continuing to reach out and want to be in my life and hang out is like adding all the stress and pressure of like, I don't want to, I want to invest in the friendships that I have that mean a lot to me.
For sure. But I would actually posit that it's so much more harmful to not have the direct conversation.
I know.
Right? Because like, how much more does it hurt poor Molly's feelings when she's like, hey, Jess, can we hang out? Oh, you're busy again. Oh, okay. Hey, Jess, can we hang out? Oh, you're washing your hair this month. You're washing your hair this month. Oh, okay. Right. And so I think it's being a direct, like communicating directly is always the kindest, most loving choice. True. Because it also lets other people stop thinking that there's potential promise where there isn't any.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I hear my clients, we talk a lot about relationships, about dating, about breakups in my programs. And there is that theme there too of like, I don't want to break up with this person because they'll be so hurt. Mm. But like, you're hurting them by staying with them when you don't want to be with them. Right. They're perfect. Yeah. Somebody is out there. And if you know that they're not your perfect somebody, release them back to the wild. Right? To go live their life. And poor sweet Molly too, let her go find some girlfriends who are like more aligned with her and actually want to hang out with her. Cause someone thinks that Molly is amazing and wants to hear about her real estate business.
Yeah.
Like someone wants to hear about it.
Can I break this down a little bit too? Because I feel like there are levels again. So you've got a friend that you've known forever that you don't necessarily want to maintain things with. It seems like absolutely that person with your history deserves to hear from you what has happened, and can be as simple as there's space between us. We've grown apart I want to make room for you in my life, but I just feel, I don't know. I can't perfect this right now, but
doesn't need to be perfect. Right.
I'm not available. I'm not, So there's that. And then I'm wondering here with this sort of other situation where you've got acquaintances. I definitely have acquaintances and people that I do like, but I don't have time for more friendships and commitments. It's really just that. It's like, I don't have enough time and I already have my solid friends. And I also, maybe we really don't click as much. Mm. And with people like that, it feels awkward to be like, I don't know. I often find that when those people reach out, it's just kind of, I'm sorry, I can't, it's continually, I'm not available, but do I need to explain anything deeper when we really are just acquaintances?
You're just like slowly ghosting them, which is kind of
but you're not answering, but you're just not, you are busy. That's really it.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan, like, of being honest, because the way we do anything is the way we do everything. And so when we're dishonest in one relationship, we're bringing that into the rest of our lives, and we're avoiding what we imagine may potentially be conflict. And we're carrying that into the rest of our lives too, into the relationships we actually care about. And most importantly, into the relationship with ourselves, right? Because for me, it's a ding on my integrity to not be honest in every relationship.
Yeah, I guess I saw it as sort of like, I'm being honest in the fact that I'm too busy to hang out. But at the same time, I think what I could say is, I'm so sorry that I'm never available. You know, I really am kind of at my maximum with relationships and work. And, you know, I don't want to hurt you and that I can't hang out, but that's just where I'm at in my life right now.
Yeah. And I think you could even distill that down to, thank you so much for reaching out. I'm at max capacity right now. I'll let you know if that changes XOXO.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And then, sorry.
Oh, did you have, cause I had like one other little question in the same, but I don't want to.
No, go.
Get yours in too. I just was wondering, it is not the exact same situation, but like if you have had a friendship that was at one point really solid and kind of, you know, you've had like where I was talking about this confrontation with them that didn't go well, and you're wanting to get over it and move on, because at this point it's like, clearly, you know, there were maybe some things left unsaid, but like it wasn't reciprocated, or, you know, you just need closure. And I feel like, how do you, you know, you've said what you need to say, you were honest, and it's just not going to work out. Like your communication styles aren't ever going to be on the same page. It's not healthy for you at this point, but like, you're still kind of obsessing over it. How do you find closure from that? And just know, like, I said what I need to say. I was authentic, and now I need to close that chapter and move on. So I don't have all of the stress with that relationship that then is impacting my physical health.
Sure. So two things again. One, closure is an inside job. No one else can give you closure. Finito. The end, right? Closure is something that we give to ourselves by aligning ourselves in our nervous system, anchoring into ventral vagus. And from there, from feeling grounded and anchored in ourselves, creating a new thought, choosing a new thought, practicing a new thought that allows us to then create the feeling of closure, right? And then taking action that's aligned with continuing to strengthen that new belief, that new narrative in our minds to continue to create the feeling of closure. Right. So when your brain, I think of our brains like a card catalog, like back in the day in the library, and there's all these thoughts written in there, and your brain will just randomly, it's like a card catalog run by angry chimps. And they're just like, I'm going to give you a card. And your brain gives you a thought, and you don't have to believe it. I think we don't realize that we don't have to believe our thoughts. We don't have to go with them. We don't have to act from them. We can just, when your brain says, you're a terrible friend because you hurt Molly's feelings. And oh my, right? You can just say like, mind monkey, monkey mind. Thank you so much. But I'm not available for that thought. Like, that's not true, right? And I don't need to ruminate on that anymore. So that's one. Two, studies show that a technique called psychological distancing is really helpful when we're ruminating. And so it's a technique in which we talk to ourselves as though we were another person. So for me, that might sound like, Maria Victoria, let's be real. This is over. You did the best you could. You showed up with love and a full open heart. I trust that you did your best. And this is the outcome. And fighting reality is not going to get you anywhere. It's really time to remember you've let this go. Right. And that can really, particularly like you were saying, that late at night, your brain is ruminating, it's spinning. And this is helpful for whatever your brain is spinning on. Like, did I remember to start the laundry? Like, did I write whatever should I have married that my, you know, high school sweetheart, whatever your brain is ruminating on, using that talking to yourself in the third person can be really, really, really helpful. And then I guess I want to add a third one, if you don't mind, which is, okay, I'm back. which is to not push through it. So I think we're really, really taught to like push through and let it go and just release it and get over it. And I just, it's not how animals work. Like, it's not a loving, kind, compassionate approach for mammals. Instead, what I would recommend and invite you to do and invite us to do is, instead of letting it go, be with it. Don't release it. Be with it. Be with the sadness. Sit with the anger, the upset, the disappointment, the frustration, the sorrow, the grief. Like, really take it to your favorite place to cry. Mine too are the cold tile bathroom floor because of the pathos involved. Like, it's so pathetic and it really helps me to cry. I love that. I guess I have three. The second is under like a really fluffy down comforter, right? And it's just like this perfect cocoon of crying. And then my third, just for New York City, is the 6 train during the middle of the day, because that's empty. And you can just like, and it's so pathetic to cry on the subway that it just, it really helps you to get it out. But like really just being with it and allowing it instead of fighting it and resisting it and trying to feel better and trying to use the techniques and trying to like, one, two, three, four, right? And just let yourself just cry.
Yeah.
Because we need that. We need to complete the stress activation cycle. And a damn good cry is magical. Like, if you've ever met a toddler, they're champions at it, right? They hurt their finger and they come to you and they say, "I hurt my finger," right? And if they
Charlie bit my finger.
Charlie bit my finger. God damn you, Charlie. God. Right. If they get attuned to, if their nervous system gets met, they crawl in your lap and they cry and they cry, and then they're just done because they've let it process through their body somatically. They're not involving their neocortex, their prefrontal cortex, the executive function, talky, thinky, monkey mind part of the brain. It's not coming in to tell stories. I should be over this. I shouldn't feel this. Ah, what's wrong with me? They just are an animal. And they let their animal just be. And they cry and they cry and they say, "Okay, I'm going to go play huecos now." They run away and play huecos because huecos are delicious. I mean, fun. I don't need fun.
Yeah, we don't need them.
No.
What if you
stopped on one at 3 a.m.? Yeah. You know how terrible they are.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
the worst.
What if you struggle crying? Like, that is such a crazy question, but I feel like the girl in that movie, The Holiday, Cameron Diaz, where she's like trying to cry and she's like, "Come on, tears, come on, come on." Mm-hmm. And I am an emotional person. I'm an empath. I'm a coach. Mm. Like, I'm very emotional, but crying for me, for some reason, I don't cry very often at all. And it's, I don't know if I'm resisting it. I don't know. I honestly like don't really know. Yeah. Sometimes it'll happen, but I'll be like in a movie, you know, or a commercial or something, not necessarily when I feel like I should be crying or when I need to cry, you know?
Right. I do. So a couple things for folks, and I'm not saying this is you, I'm just saying in general, for folks who do spend a lot of time in dorsal, it can be hard to cry. Often because the organism is just exhausted and can't sort of muster that much endorphin. Really. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. Two, if it's been conditioned out of us to cry. And again, not saying this is you, but a lot of us grew up hearing that it wasn't okay to cry, that emotions weren't allowed, that emotions wouldn't be validated. We wouldn't get the love and care we needed. It took me quite a while of retraining and really learning how to regulate my nervous system and hold space for myself somatically to be able to cry when, like you said, I needed to, like I could feel that need in my body. Mm-hmm. It just like, it was like it got stuck somewhere. And that for me, was it a dorsal response? Was it a shutdown response? So the more you can regulate your nervous system, the easier it is. And then, you know, again, because science, there are outliers everywhere. There are people whose bodies don't use crying as a release. Most of us do, right? It releases endorphins and dopamine. Like, crying is a nervous system release, but we're all individuals. So it may not be something to pathologize or see as a problem. It may just be you, but yeah, overall, I'd say it's something to get curious about.
Yeah.
I feel like you're an outlier, Jess.
Yeah, but
I don't think she's in dorsal. That
no, I'm not. I don't think I'm in dorsal. Really, yeah, that doesn't resonate at all. Yeah. But yeah, I think maybe I'm the outlier. I know, because I do feel like I don't necessarily crave that, you know, release. Like, I feel like I do release in other ways, but then I wonder, I'm like, am I not crying enough? Like, I should be crying in this moment, but I'm not. So anyway, that was super, super helpful. Okay. I know you had another question, right? Before we wrap up.
Oh, I think you actually, you had the same question that I was going to ask, and we're coming beyond the time that we said we take with you. So thank you so much for all of this wisdom. We could absolutely do a part two or even three with all of your knowledge.
And let's do it.
That would be really great.
Yeah. You know,
like codependency for people that are in codependent relationships, for example, how to heal the gut, adrenal fatigue. Yeah. These are all things that are so related to our experiences and also our business. So, so thank you for all of your knowledge today. If we do have time for one last question, we always like to hear maybe just a few or even two of your favorite daily rituals or self-care non-negotiables that really help you stay balanced mentally and help you really ensure that you're prioritizing your health and well-being.
Oh my gosh. Well, my brain just offered like 200 million options.
I know.
But I make sure to do at least one somatic practice and thought work every single day. And they're two of the core teachings that I share with my clients. So a somatic practice I've been doing a lot lately is doing figure eights with my arms. And I'll put music on and do this motion over and over, sort of rhythmically. I'll play with it. I'll get really curious. Like, what does it feel like in my body today to stand on my left leg while moving my arm? To stand on both legs, to lower my center of gravity, to stand on my tiptoes. What if I use one leg and one arm, right? So I'll use somatics to get really curious about my nervous system, about my body, about my mental state, and to hold space for my body to release whatever it needs to. And so I'll always do that before going to thought work, because I'm a smarty pants nerd. I used my intellect as a buffer against feeling my feelings for a very, 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 very long time. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to drop myself immediately into cognition, into thinking, into getting meta with my thoughts until I've checked in with my body. And throughout the process of thought work, I'll come back to the body and go to thought work, come back to the body and go back to my thinking. Right? Because mind and body both matter, and it needs to be in balance for me. So those are the two things that came to mind. That and peeing when I need to.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Ryan and I are the queen of pee.
I'm so glad.
Oh yeah. No, we are. We pee like every 5 minutes.
I mean, seriously. Yeah, it's important.
It is important, but I can relate to that. Yeah. Pushing it back just to stay working.
Right. Stay focused.
It's absurd. But thank you.
I have to pee so bad right now.
We'll let you go. Final thing, how can everyone find you? Listen to your podcast. You have amazing episodes.
Thank you. So you can find me on Instagram at Victoria Albina Wellness. I give good gram. You can find my podcast, Feminist Wellness, which is for humans of all genders, on all the places. It's everywhere for free every Thursday. If you head on over to victoriaalbina.com/solo, I made a present for your listeners. Isn't that fun?
That's awesome. So
there's a set of meditations, nervous system orienting exercise, all sorts of goodies available for free for download for solo listeners. So victoriaalbina.com/solo. And you can also learn about my 6-month program, Anchored Overcoming Codependency, right on my website, victoriaalbina.com/anchored.
Amazing. Thank you. I'm looking it up right now and I can't wait to use these resources.
I learned so much from you in this short amount of time, and I'm just so appreciative for all of your knowledge and obviously the passion that you exude in the work that you do. And I'm definitely going to be using some of these like tool, like the arm, my arm. Yeah. I'm still doing it right now. It feels so good.
It does feel so good. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll let you go. And let's stay in touch for sure.
Yeah.